Noble silence is starting to bite. Yes, lots of questions. Okay. The breath sometimes arises during metta meditation. What can I do with that? I think that if you're doing metta meditation, it's just kind of radiating goodwill and friendliness towards, you know, different beings. And if things start to settle down and you notice the breath, then you can, whichever is the more, you feel, whichever you feel is the strongest, either the feeling of warmth in the chest or the breath. If the mind settles on the breath, then just kind of let go of the verbalizing in your mind, and just allow the mind to settle on the breath. But sometimes if it just, you know, goes in and fades out, and just continue with your metta meditation. Depends on whichever you feel, whichever the mind's inclining towards, the strongest. Does that make sense? Questions or comments? Clarifications? Same with the body. Once you settle the body, you swept through it, and then the breath comes up, then just stay with the breath. Even if you're halfway through the body, and for some reason the mind is very still, stable, and then the breath is very clear, and you can follow it continuously, one in-breath to one out-breath for a few minutes continuously, then just stay with the breath. Means the mind is already settled down, you don't want to move to a different object. If I walk in the bush, then after 1 to 2.5 hours, my mind becomes quiet, just like it does in sitting meditation. Can I substitute this for sitting meditation? Yes, definitely. I mean, that's the kind of the object of any kind of meditation, is for the mind to become more still, more stable. And some people have inclinations towards different postures, and sometimes people have this kind of a perception, an image that for meditations you have to sit cross-legged, sit still with your eyes closed. But it's not entirely true. The Buddha recommended the 4 postures. The sitting, obviously, but also the walking, standing. You feel after we sit for a while and your back starts to ache, you can stand as well. And then also lying down meditation. Those are the 4 postures that you can meditate in. I think most people, lying down is not so easy, because it's all in conditioning. The only time we lie down on our back is when we're getting ready to go to sleep. So if you do, for some reason you have a bad back and you can only meditate with lying down, do it in a posture that you normally don't sleep in. So if you sleep in your back, then when you do your lying down meditation, lie on the right side or the left side. And then always do that meditation in that posture. That way you kind of program the mind a little bit, saying, okay, this is not sleepy time, this is kind of meditation time. And over, after a while, the mind will get used to it. But initially, if you're doing lying down meditation, you will fade to sleeping meditation if you're not careful. Yeah. So definitely, if you're walking and it feels peaceful, and especially if it does, like when you're sitting meditation, you're definitely to continue that. And to also do more of that. If that feels comfortable, it feels good. Yeah, definitely. Any questions, comments? Okay. Okay. How can Buddhism help me with domestic violence and abuse? Do I have to accept it or try to make peace at home? How to protect young kids? Ooh, heavy topic. I think in terms of domestic violence and abuse, Buddhism It's more of the training of the mind. And if you find yourself in a situation, then I think obviously you have to decide whether to stay in this or to leave in a way that obviously to think clearly. The situation is obviously very confusing. Could be very very emotional, obviously. So I think when you do make any big decisions regarding relationships, to do it when you are in a calm, stable mind, as calm as stable as you can get it in this obviously very difficult situation. And how Buddhism can help, I think Buddhism is about the training of the mind, where there have to be some kind of a stable foundation first. You have to be in a position where things are relatively stable, where you're in a good space. So I think when you're in such a difficult situation like this to begin with, you can still apply Buddhism in the sense that, yes, this is the suffering of having a relationship. Things can go very, very wrong. And also to accept that these things can happen. There is no guarantee in life. No one, the fine print in your marriage certificate doesn't guarantee you to a life of peace and domestic bliss. Although we like to think that, and we like to hope that it works out, from time to time these things happen. So to first to accept that these things happen, but also to take steps to remedy it. Either remove yourself from the situation, whatever ways you can, but also not to allow somebody else's action to contaminate your own mind. Which means when you do move away from the situation, not to allow vengefulness to live with you, not to allow anger, irritation, or guilt to continue in your mind. Practice as much as you can forgiveness. We don't understand why people behave the way they do. Maybe it's obviously, I'm assuming this is a man. Maybe your husband or your partner had an abusive relationship when he was growing up. I'm not trying to justify him, but trying to understand where people may be coming from. And also to understand that when people act in violent manners, that they themselves are suffering tremendously. And then they also have to live with the consequences of their action later. So Buddhism can help you understand that in that way, to accept the situation from a realistic kind of perspective, and then also to act, hopefully from compassion, but also to move away from this vengefulness, from this kind of wanting to strike back. But also to reflect on a different level, in the sense that to be on the receiving end of anger, it's not very pleasant. So we can learn from that. We can say, okay, may I kind of avoid reacting out of anger the next time I'm in a bad mood. Okay. How to accept it and try to make peace at home. Like I said, domestic violence is also very difficult to accept. I think on a certain level, we owe it to ourselves and also to protect the kids. So if you act, you have to protect the kids by just moving away, removing yourself from the situation as best as you can. But also, but not to allow somebody else's negative action to contaminate your own mind. Just leave that bad karma, where it is. And going forward, trying to, with meditation, practice of letting go, as much as you can to purify your mind away from these kind of negative emotions. A story comes to mind was that, like the Dalai Lama. You probably know what happened to Tibet. The Chinese government did terrible, cruel things to his monks and his monasteries. They basically pretty much burned most of it down. They forced the monks and nuns to commit sexual intercourse so that they could be disrobed, and they do all those terrible things. And while the Dalai Lama was in the States, he was followed around by a reporter who asked him, you know, how do you feel about this? What they've done to you, you know, the temples, what they've done to your country. You know, how do you feel? And the Dalai Lama was a very wise, very compassionate, monk. And he said, you know, they've taken everything of value, everything I love, everything that I worship from my life, the Chinese government. But I'm not going to give them my mind. And the only way to do that is, you know, to forgive, to allow it to fade into the ground, no matter how atrocious the situation is. If you hold on to it through anger, through vengefulness, then you're allowing somebody else's action to continue to pollute your own mind. So that's a very drastic example, obviously, but it also points that we have control. We can relate through our mind. We are responsible for our own happiness or suffering. Nobody else can do that. We suffer over another person's act because we're allowing them to dictate our happiness. So through mindfulness, through clarity of mind, we can. And with through the examples of the Dalai Lama, you know, he obviously a very well attained monk. To be able to take all that and say, yes, you know, these are horrible things that people have done. But you know, holding a grudge is not going to help the situation. What happened already happened. But you know, if he moved forward, you know, and like I said, he's working towards peace, he's working towards, you know, helping his people with different kind of educational programs. So there's positive you can do. But never allow someone's bad deed to pollute your mind. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions or comments? And there's this question, sorry, I apologize to whoever wrote this question, I forgot it yesterday. It was on the bottom of the pile. It says, can you speak about motherhood and Buddhism? Well, having never been a mother, that's a pretty tall order. I think the only thing that comes to mind in terms of this, you know, the motherhood in Buddhism is the simile of the chanting we just did on loving kindness. You kind of treat all beings as a mother with her only child. And although I've never been a mother, I do have a mother, and I've seen other mothers in action with their kids. And it's true that the patience and the unconditional love that a mother has to her kid, it is unbounded. It was a brilliant simile when the Buddha kind of used it for loving kindness. Because you can see, you know, the mothers with their infants. The kid, you know, can do all sorts of things that most other people would not accept. You know, it can defecate on her, she can pull her hair, do other things, and the only thing she reacts is just kindness and just through doting. And just pure love, no matter what the child does. And that's a great state of mind for each and every one of us to cultivate. Whoever's in front of us, just to view them as a little child, infant in front of us, our mind. And just to accept them, to embrace them, to nurture them any way we can. So it's a great ideal to strive for. A mother's love to her only child. Yeah, it's quite amazing. It's something I try to keep in mind. And no matter what you do, certainly myself, my case in mind, no matter what you do, you cannot disappoint. You always, you know, she always looks at your actions, your achievement in the most the brightest light. You know, the mistakes that you made, oh, they're nothing. And the little things that you do, they're the greatest achievement in the world, in her eyes. And I think it must be the same with all mothers. Looking at her kids just with such kind, gentle, and caressing perspective. So that's my only take on motherhood in Buddhism. Anybody else who wants to comment on this? But also, on the other way, to kind of caution people, you know, motherhood, fatherhood, childhood, Robinhood. We're meditators. So we try to, it's a path of letting go. So we come in here and we have, you know, a certain kind of identity that we identify with. I'm young, I'm old, I'm new with this. It's an obstacle towards letting go. So when we move inward, we're leaving all that behind. Whether you're a, you know, good meditator, an old hand at this, or completely new, you're not used to this, whether you're old or young, you have a fit body, or you have a bad back, all that is slowly, we're moving away from all that. We're just a mind, really. A body and a mind. And when you move towards unity, it's just one breath. First in the present moment, and then just one breath at a time. Each one of us. Just a being breathing in and breathing out, really. And the more we move away from the signs and the labels, the more peace there is. Also, when we look at each other, it's not a man, it's not a woman in front of us, it's just a meditator. It's not an Australian or an Asian, it's just another meditator. So there's less, you know, so there's less things, less baggage to carry around. We're moving towards simplicity, unity, one-pointedness, where all these identifications are left behind. And it's true, I mean, you know, once you really get into meditating, all the social issues really fade away. Not to say that they're not important, they are important, but I think once we moved to stillness and have that clarity of mind, then we can, when we reemerge from meditation, we can engage in a world in a much more useful, much more profound way than if we just get caught in the surface of things, the different social issues. Yes, any questions or comments? Having said that, we are. I realize that being a man, I can only say things from obviously from a male perspective, and not anything else. So I think next year we're trying to invite maybe a nun to lead the retreat, where you can have a different perspective into the Dhamma, a different way to relate to the Dhamma. Obviously, things are ultimately they don't matter, but until you are there, enlightened, they do make a difference. And I do acknowledge that it's going to be helpful to have a lady, a nun, to lead some of the retreats. Yeah. Moving on. Can Bhante explain concentration of the breath and the feeling? Which one is more important? The breath is the only, your only contact with the breath is the feeling, you know, what it feels in the body. So when you're noticing the in-breath, it's either the sensation in your nose, the rise and the fall in your chest and your abdomen. So what, you know, is that contact. The breath manifests in a physical sensation. So that is usually what I focus on. The physical sensation of the breath somewhere in the body, wherever it's the clearest for you. Okay. And feeling, I think, at least according to the Pali word, is the vedana. It's not exactly the feeling how we understand it, it's more of the emotional content of the feeling, either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that's the feeling. And that sometimes come up from time to time when you're sitting in meditation, especially feeling from the body. You're sitting for an hour, usually the feeling of dukkha vedana, of pain comes up. And just to watch that. And these things, with anything else that the Buddha taught, comes and go on its own accord. You might think that, you know, we are causing it, somehow it comes up, but actually these vedanas, these feelings, come and go according to their own causes and condition. In deep states of meditation, you can see that feeling is different and the body is something else. They're not bound together. But for most of us, you know, feeling usually it's in the body somewhere. You have an ache in your knee, actually feels like your knee is hurting. But like when I say a Thai meditation master just says, well, actually, you know, a dead person doesn't feel any pain. So actually the pain is not in the body somewhere, it's in the mind. All this khandas is in the mind. And that's where ultimately feeling arises from, it's in the mind. And sometimes you get deep meditation, the feeling, the pain in your knee or your back completely disappears on its own. So on a certain level, there is kind of, you know, independence between the body and the feeling associated with that. And it's something for each and every one of us to investigate for ourselves. But I think for most of us, yes, there's lots of feelings and it seems to be tied to the body. Any questions or comments? Yes? That's right. The five aggregates is what the Buddha, he dissect the human body and mind to find these five groupings, we call it. First is the body, which is just, you know, the physical aspect of us. And actually, yeah, so it's just, you know, this lump of flesh we have. And second is the feeling, but it's kind of, what is that? It's not feeling like I feel like I like you or not like you. It's a feeling, it's like I was telling before, it's a feeling of happiness or suffering or in something in between. So we have that as well. We have that group of feeling that comes up. When your thought comes up, usually there's an emotional tone, like, not like, or something in between. All feelings come into that category. You know, positive, negative, or neutral. And then there is... what's the other one? What? Perception, that's what it is, very good. Well, perception. The perceptions, a lot of it, it's interesting how the Buddha divided up the human existence of body and mind. Only the first one. We pay a lot of attention to the body, but he only gave it one of the grouping. The rest is all mental phenomena. The feeling is certainly in the mind, and the perception, how we see, we perceive things from memories. Yeah, you know, perception is more than that, but it's mostly memories. Yeah, there's perception, and then there is a sankhara. It's the... I'm not going to be able to go with this. That's right. There's narupa, there's vedana, and there is sanya, and there's sankhara, which is mostly sankharas is another mental phenomenon, and that is will. This is where our will comes from. It's a sankhara, the wanting. So the intention, yeah. That is what I'm trying to say. It's intention. And there's last, and it seems to be related, consciousness as well. This awareness to know what is happening. So the human body is really, the human experience, this mind-body is only one part body, and the rest of it, the Buddha divided into this mental phenomena, mental aspect. And they are actually separate domains on their own. The body is just four elements, and it moves around because there's consciousness inside the body. And once we, you know, once the body grows old, it gets sick, it breaks down, the other four khandhas still moves on. It's this kind of energy that moves on to different existence, according to Buddhist cosmology. Right. And ultimately, it is the mental khandhas that's the most important. That's where we pay the most attention to training of the mind, the consciousness. It's all, you know, everything is locked into the mind. And is there any specific question regarding the five khandhas you want to ask, or just what are they, or? That's right, yeah. I think what you're getting at is also has to do with the, you know, it gets a bit technical, but it has to do with the 12 links of, you know, kind of dependent origination. And what explains that, you know, this mind and body here. But actually, it also explains the process of rebirth for Buddhism. Is that, you know, there's something that follows from lifetime after lifetime, and it's an energy, but it's not a you, it's not a soul, because, you know, we think, you know, if something follows one lifetime to another, you're always this person inside. You're either a woman all the time, or you're a man, or you're this personality. You're, you know, a Kamawaro that goes from lifetime to lifetime. But it's not like that. It's also has a non-self, that you can become a different being. You can become a man next time, you're a woman this time, animal, a different rebirth. And it's just this kind of energy that passes. It's like, you know, you have a mango tree, and it gets a fruit, it goes down, and it has another fruit. So it comes from this old mango tree, but it's not exactly the same thing. Or like the flame of a candle. When a candle is just about to go out, you light a flame to it. Is it the same flame or a different flame? So that's how consciousness also gets transformed from one to another. But it gets a bit technical, but basically that's how rebirth takes place according to a Buddhist, you know, theory. According to Buddhist, you know, Buddhist teachings. That it's just more like an energy from the flame. You know, we exist because the three causes. You have the heat, you have the light, and you have the wax. And that's why the candle gets burned, keeps burning. But any of the causes gets taken away, then the candle stops. So if it's the wind, it takes away the heat, the candle goes out, doesn't go anymore. And the consciousness is stopped. So anyway, when you burn, life burns all the way down, and the flame, and you hold up another candle, and the flame gets transferred. So it's not exactly the same flame. It's a new existence. And the thing that goes from one lifetime to the next is craving. We want to be born, basically. Because obviously our attachments to our family, our kids, our house, or just being, to experience more things. And that's why we get reborn, because we want to, basically. But once we get reborn, we get old, get sick, and we die again. And that's not very fun. But we don't get that. So we keep doing this over and over and over again. Until we finally meet a good teacher who explains that all this is a bit of a pain to always be reborn again, have to go to school, having, you know, grown up, have to have kids, have to fight with your kids, fight with your husband, and after a while you say, okay, I've had enough of this, I don't want to come back again. And then you don't come back, because you've exhausted all your craving. You learn how to meditate, you let go of your sense of self, let go of all the desires, let go of the wanting, let go of the anger as well, letting go of the delusion. And once you learn all that, and you build up this momentum over many lifetimes, and in one lifetime, you make peace with everything. You say, I've had enough. I've been, you know, man, woman, animal, king, queen, a rock star, everything else in between. I've had enough. I don't want to come back again. And so that's the process of how these things work. Yeah. Does that make sense? Questions or comments? With anything, these are just out there for your contemplation, and you make use of what you can. The stuff that's kind of weird, you can just leave it behind. You can still meditate and get peaceful. And live wholesome life without having to kind of buy into all this Buddhist cosmology. Because, like the Buddha said, the Dhamma is also to apply in this very life. Something that's timeless. Something you can always make use of. Yeah? Moving on. When I meditate, I keep phrasing or describing with words everything I feel. For example, I feel the fabric against my skin, body awareness. I wish you well, I wish you happy, metta. I feel the cool air going in my nostril, breathing. I can just feel, visualize without putting words everywhere. Is that normal, a problem? I can't just feel with visualize without putting words everywhere. Is that a normal? Is that a problem? No, I think it's normal. We like to verbalize things. We like to talk to ourselves when we are sitting quietly. But also, once the mind becomes more calm, actually, it will drop that gradually, and will drop it eventually. But it's not something we can force. A lot of times, but you notice, there's two things. You feel it and then you label it. And that's what we're trying to do through schooling, through, you know, university, or just social interaction. We're always kind of visualizing, verbalizing to ourselves. But I think the feeling is before it. It's, you know, once you're aware of it, and then you verbalize it. So once the mind becomes more bright, more clear, you just feel it without having to verbalize it. You just know the context of your breathing. Without having to say the wind in my nose or the rise and fall in my chest. You just know it. But in the beginning, verbalizing is not a problem. At least it keeps you aware in the present moment of what's happening. You're not drifting up, at least you are. And that's why I think the Mahasi, you know, method is good, because it helps you to note. But it only goes so far. You note after a while, but after a while when mind is really peaceful, it drops the noting automatically. But in the beginning, the noting, the describing, the verbalizing is very helpful, just to keep abreast of what's happening. Otherwise, we drift off to different places. So the verbalizing is not a problem. It's actually a good starting point. And once the mind becomes more calm, you can just drop it. Or it drops it automatically. Yeah, you won't notice anymore. After a while, just take the breathing, for example. Once the mind settles into the breath, it happens automatically. You don't have to kind of force the mind, the breath, it just happens. You're just aware of one breath after another, continuously for a long, long time. It's like you're driving on automatic. You don't have to do anything. It happens automatically. And the verbalizing, all that begins to drop away. But in the beginning, it takes some effort to kind of focus onto the breath. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Yeah. Okay. Moving on. This is a very genuine place. And all of the people here are genuine. We're just like to ask why are lotus flowers in the fish pond fake? What? Is it fake? You sure? What? All this time. Oh no, now I'm disappointed. No. The lotus flowers are fake, but you know what's genuine? The genuine is the act of generosity. And that's the reason why we keep it. Because that act, that intention of giving was genuine. And that's what I'm honoring when I look at that. Not my favorite flowers. Kind of pink and bright, but you know, these people brought it. And they bought it from the grocery store. They drove 2.5 hours here. They put it in the pond, and with so much faith and devotion. So that's what I see when I see those flowers. I see the faith and devotion people put into it. And it's the same with the offerings we get. You know, we like the food I like, but I don't like. But it's the same intention people come. So that's the reason why we look. Yeah, some of the stuff we have around is kind of I wouldn't put it into my place, but as a monk, you're trying to get beyond your what you like and don't like, and just an honor to this intention when they come. Yeah. So yes, the flowers are fake, but the intentions are genuine. Okay. We've been here before. Could you talk about sankharas, please? Not the same. Maybe I get some tooth to talk about this. Sankharas are intentions. It's the willpower. It's the will, mostly. The fashioning. But that's...
It was my question.
Yeah.
What exactly? Yeah. Last year I did a retreat up at Mr. Goenka's.
Yeah.
Like, not in the sense you talk about, but in releasing pain.
Okay, yeah.
Like you're sitting in it, you talked about not to be in a uncomfortable position.
That's right.
But he would often say, make you sit for an hour in a position, because, and at the end of 10 days you would have released sankhara, which was the pain that you were still, like, sitting through, and it would release.
I think sankharas has it's also one of this Buddhist term that has many different meanings depending on the context. And sankhara also a wider term, like, you know, the most commonly used is in terms of intention, it's your will. But also a wider term, another very popular term for the sankhara is the what do you call it? Fashioning. It's when things come together. That's sankhara. The making of things, you know, everything is the sankharas, really. The body is the sankhara, because it comes, makes up four elements, comes together, and then it breaks apart after a while. And it's the same with the feeling in our, you know, body. It comes together, it stays for a while, and it also passes away. So in that sense, maybe, you know, Mr. Goenka is using the sankharas, that these things, everything's impermanent. And that's what I took one of that course before I became a monk. And then that's, he using that to study the pain or the feeling in the body. A lot of it is, you know, the pain is because we label it as pain. But after a while, you have this, you know, the strong mindfulness, the clarity of mind to watch it. It's just another sensation, another sankhara, another manifestation of you know, a mental phenomenon. So that's why I think he's using that, that the sankharas, these things come together into a group, and then they stay for a while, and then they disperse. And it's the same with anything. And then pain is one of the sankharas, that if we have the patience to observe it with clarity, with gentleness, they do eventually fade away. It might take, you know, 8 hours, 12 hours of sitting through pure pain, pure hell. But eventually, if you have the mindset, they do fade away. And that's, you know, I have personal experience of that, not sitting so long, but, you know, sitting for a few hours or whatever, and yeah, one day it just disappears. I'm not saying it disappears every time I sit, but, you know, every so often it does that. And that's not, that's how come you can kind of infer that these things, are under control, and we do them, but actually they come and they break up on their own. And that's why sitting still and watching the pain in your knee or whatever, eventually it does get released or it changes. But the reason I don't encourage people to do that is I think there's enough stress, enough dukkha in our lives already. They don't want to come and meditate and then to experience more dukkha by sitting through pain. So I think sitting through pain is not a bad exercise. You have a lot of faith and you are quite patient and you're inclined that way. But if sitting through pain brings up a lot of kind of aversion, and it sets up a kind of relationship to meditation, a negative one, then it's not so useful. That's the reason I say, when you start out meditation, try to make it as comfortable as you can. And then you associate meditation with something that's you know, enjoyable, and you do it more often. And then once your mind is clear, when it's more stable, then you can experiment with sitting through pain. Eventually we all have to do it, because if you're sitting for any length of time, pain will appear. And to get through that, you have to eventually get through that pain barrier sooner or later. Just to kind of, through mindfulness or through patient endurance, allow the pain to stay. And then one fine day, it does disappear. Yeah? Yeah, so that's maybe his use of sankhara in that way. Any questions or comments regarding sankharas? Any of the other five groups? Okay, good. Next. Sometimes I feel that my body is generating too much heat when I sit to meditate. I start to sweat. When I open my eyes, I immediately cool down. Does this mean that there could be some energy blockages in the body, or that energy levels and concentration are not in balance? Thank you, Venerable. Yeah, I think when the mind settles down, different things happen. And feeling hot over your body is also a common occurrence. It does mean there's unleashing some energy blockages in the body. Especially if you have some kind of sickness, has some kind of recent accident, then things are, you know, when you're relaxing, the body is the energy starts to circulate. It starts to heal, or it starts to become unblocked and starts to move around. So feeling hot in the body, it's not uncommon. Yeah. And it's not a problem. Only it becomes really unpleasant, too hot, and it distracts your meditation. But usually with anything, this is also a sankhara. It comes and it goes. And the thing is just to watch it. Just to be with it. To receive it. Not to try to push it away. Not to try to get excited over it. But just to be with it. And then eventually it will fade. It does its own thing. Any further questions or comments regarding that? Bhante, can you please explain what is the relationship of this monastery to Thai Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, to Vietnamese Buddhism? Is the teaching different or the same? Is meditation training the same? Many questions there. This monastery is... actually, we haven't quite figured out where we are in this... ism, the Thai, the Zen, the Vietnamese stuff. Because we're just getting started. But I think I was born in Vietnam, but I was ordained in Thailand, and I feel close with the Thai forest tradition. But also having, you know, kind of been trained in the West for 8 years, also kind of evaluating different things to go towards. But I think at the heart of it, yes, I feel a lot of gratitude, a lot of connection with the Thai meditation master. So I think going forward, trying to move towards that. But also, being in the West, you know, you adopt naturally anyway. Different things come into it. So I do see this monastery going forward to be aligned or loosely affiliated with the Thai forest tradition. Which is why we have this color robes and we eat from the bowl. I think in Vietnamese Zen, they eat on the table, which is a different way of relating to things. And that's why we also eat before noon, because the teachings are simple and we don't have any money and we don't cook for ourselves or store food. So that's, these things are just very traditional Thai Buddhist practices. And the teaching that we follow, the teaching that we practice, is aligned to what with the earlier teaching of Buddhism. Kind of mainly taking our inspiration, our source, from the Pali, which is the ancient language of the Buddha, what he left behind. Right? So it's more traditional in our approach to practice. And the meditation training is also looking forward, obviously, you know, to what the Buddha taught in the suttas, but also what the Thai first meditation master practiced. Especially Ajahn Chah, which is where my lineage came from, is, you know, he practiced and he taught in a very direct, earthy way, not very complicated, something that everybody can, you know, kind of relate to. So we strive to do the same. Because in my teaching, I try not to bring too much Pali word into it, and to explain in a way that people can apply that in their everyday life. especially meditation, to always go back to, you know, how does this help you to solve daily difficulties, or how does this help you to further your meditation? Try to make it kind of, you know, useful, and not to make it too theoretical. Does that make sense? Any other questions or comments? Anything more specific? How can one talk about, have discussions about religions with other people who has different religious views peacefully? Thank you, Bhante. Yeah, I think in this day and age, it's not how, but you almost have to, because, you know, there is the, with internet, globalization, we are living very close to each other, different religions, different practices. So I think when, you know, in my own discussions with other religions or even other lineage of Buddhism, to always stress, you know, what we have in common instead of always going for what differences we have. And to also see that actually, you know, our religion always preached, you know, gentleness and kindness, really. People might use the quotes differently to justify wars or whatever, but actually those, you know, the religious leaders always preach, you know, compassion and kindness, really. So look towards commonality instead of differences. And once you kind of have a bond already, then you can start, you know, to discuss, to explore our differences. But initially, I think, you know, for harmony's sake, to stress what we have in common and the ideals that we have is actually, you know, very similar. And even across different religions, there is always a most of the large, you know, the main religions have a meditative tradition. And once you meditate and you train the mind, it's actually, you know, we all have the same mind. Maybe different vocabularies to describe the experiences, but a lot of times you have a good meditator in front of you. Even from different traditions, you have very similar things to discuss about. I think Ram, we were in Perth. We visit the what are they again? The not the Sarian, they are the New Norsen, monks, and the Christian monks, and you'd be amazed how much common things we have together. And Ashram Brahma was saying, you know, the other abbots, they talk and they have the same abbot suffering. Because all the young monks that want to change everything when they come. The same with, you know, young Buddhist monks, they come out, oh, we don't want to keep this rule, we don't want to keep this rule, we don't want to change this. And same with the Christian monks. The same different issues. And also especially you have, you know, in a monastery, you know, different issues, you know, arises from how to, you know, which rules to keep, which rules to kind of modify. So actually we have a lot more in common. And actually, you know, the abbot of the other Christian monastery, and Ajahn Brahma, quite close friends. So we visit each other once a year. You know, we go to their monastery once and they come to ours. And yeah, actually a very pleasant afternoon to discuss things with each other. Because it is true spiritual life, you know, beyond the politics and beyond the kind of labeling. But, you know, if you have integrity, you have sincerity to pursue this kind of, this goodness inside, this spiritual path, it's all very similar. And whether there is a God or not, you find out yourself at the end of the path through your own insight, through your own meditation. You don't have to take anybody else's word for it. You can see for yourself. And that's what, you know, Buddhism, but also other, you know, religion emphasize. Questions or comments? Clarifications?
Of
I think there's healthy skepticism. You have to, there's a spirit of inquiry. So there's certain doubt that's involved in that, to inquire. Yeah. But also I think you look closely, actually all religion demand a certain, you know, almost faith. So there's, I guess, true. I mean, there's faith and there's blind faith. So, but you know, how much, you know, where is the fine line? Because, you know, as you know, a lot of the meditation masters demand tremendous amount of faith from the disciples, you know, to go with, you know, to fast for weeks or to take really strange practices. And that takes an amazing amount of faith. But it's true, it's not blind in the sense that, it's sort of blind to say, well, I have a lot of faith in my teacher, I think he's enlightened, he's asked me to do this, I'm going to do it. So there's certain kind of trust in it. And you do, and in my own case anyway, you notice, and you know, to look around, to pursue and to continue on a spiritual path, you need a tremendous amount of faith. Sometimes you don't like, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I just have faith that at the end of the day, it's going to work out fine. So there's some kind of large portion of blind to it, or just kind of, you know, I don't know how it all fits, but you know, I think he must know what he's doing. So there's that kind of faith involved, and you know, say faith moves mountains, and I firmly believe that. But where does that go? How does that measure against blind faith? Yeah, I guess it's not blind if you can look at your teacher. And you can, you know, and he represents the ideals. He embodies the ideals that he teaches, I suppose. You have faith that he is enlightened, he knows what he's doing. But like I said, no one knows for sure. You don't know for sure that the Buddha is enlightened. And actually, in the sutta, the Buddha said, and which is a bit tricky, and I did question Ajahn Bhamali, who is a Vinaya expert, or a Pali expert on this, that to have 100% firm faith in the Buddha, you have to be enlightened yourself. Because that's when you reach the end of the path and you see that, oh, the fruits, this works. Otherwise, along the time, there's always kind of healthy skepticism arising. Because you don't know. The only when you fully believe that the Buddha knew what he's talking about, that he was fully enlightened, is when you yourself, you know, taste the fruits of enlightenment. Then you know, okay, he knew what he's talking about. But until then, you don't know. Yeah. So you don't know for sure. And you can live with a teacher for many years, and that's what the Buddha recommended. You can see a master, and he gives great talk. Yeah. Lots of people give great talk. He has good meditation, but lots of people do that. They can do strange things and they have blind spots. And the Buddha recommended, before you take anybody as your teacher, to really investigate, to study them, and to live with them for many, many years. Because he says, you know, they can be great monks, but then maybe they become famous, and they start to change their behavior. Or they've got, you know, or they're getting good meditation, and then so they don't have any defilements in the mind. But when the meditation falls away, then these delusions come up. And you only know that if you see, when you've noticed, you live in for a long time, the meditation that's not going so well, then you see that they start acting out of anger or greed or, you know, whatever, and you can see more clearly. But as long as the meditation is going well, then it can suppress it. They're not enlightened yet, but it can suppress a lot of your craving when the meditation is going well. So it's true. I mean, you know, to say that, but it's true. Some religions do demand what to us seems like blind faith. You know, and I don't know. I just don't know enough of the Christian religion that to say that it's exactly, is it completely blind faith, or is it there's some kernel of truth or a purpose behind that. That's the thing, yeah. But also in Buddhism, you know, we do a lot of things that from the outside, it sort of looks like blind faith, you know, all that bowing, all that kind of, you know, oh, my teacher says this, I'm going to do that. But I think, you know, with close inspection, it's not, because, you know, we are bound by hierarchy and kind of etiquette to behave in a certain way, but no one forces to. We can change our mind, we can question anytime we please. But a lot of times too, I mean, you know, it's, you know, with any kind of group practices, it seems to pull in one direction. And then sometimes it's hard to kind of stand back. I don't know whether I answer your question, but... Any other comments or questions? Clarifications? Choosing to go back to normal civil life after years in monastery must be challenging for a monk. Do you think it's possible to keep living a real Buddhist life in today's city life? Thanks. Good question. Yeah, I think it's better answered by some of you out there, since you're in a city life. My life hardly qualifies as city life here. But I think the fact that everybody's here, the fact that, you know, you're giving up 5 days of your holiday to come here to a quiet place and to learn how to meditate or to continue to practice your meditation, you know, must mean that you know, you value some peace, you value stillness, and you're inclining your mind towards, you know, the spiritual life, the spiritual path. So it must mean it's possible. Don't know how easy it is, but it must mean, you know, that the awareness out there for peace and stillness and kindness must be growing. And I think when you think, it's just a balance. Obviously, when you have a family life, you have responsibility. You cannot, you know, relinquish it. You can't run away from it. But, you know, so you make the best of it. Meditate when you can, when it's most convenient, you know, for yourself as well as your partners and your family. And then, well, that's the nice thing about the spiritual path. Whatever benefit you gain here, that will be, you know, your family will be the first recipient of that, because that will come out naturally when you deal with them. They're the closest one to you. And if you're unhappy, you're depressed, angry, resentful, they will also be the inheritance of that as well. So just being here is actually not just helping yourself, but you're helping your family in ways that, you know, in ways that they can really, in palpable ways, in a very, very real sense of a word of helping your family, by calming your mind first, by being more forgiving, be more gentle, more kind when you get back. A story with Ajahn Brahm when he was started out, you know, 25-30 years ago in Perth, and they had a weekend retreat as well, and this, you know, this man wants to come, but then, you know, he Buddhism was very new, not too many people knew too much about it. So his wife asked him, what do you want to do? He said, you know, I want to go to this meditation retreat. His wife said, why do you want to do that? I said, you know, he said, well, I want to learn to meditate. Says, no, you can't. Weekend is busy. You've got to help me do the shopping. You've got to take the kids to the ball game. You know, mow the lawn. Lots of things to do on the weekend. What you do is sitting there watching your breath. No, you can't go. So he's like, okay. So he's very patient. And then a couple of weeks again, he asked her again, oh, you know, weekend retreat coming up in a couple of weeks' time. Can I go? Says, no, I told you already. Weekend's busy. I got things to do. So he says, it's persistent, just, you know, before the weekend starts. He said, okay, in a few days' time, there's a weekend retreat. Can I go? By then, she was so fed up. She said, okay, go. Leave me with the kids. Don't worry about me and the kids. Just go. You selfish man. So he went to a retreat, learned how to meditate, learned to still the mind a little bit. And he went back. And she was really surprised. He's actually a changed person. Much easier to get along with, much more sensitive to her needs and the kids, and was there. So he said the next time the retreat came around, he didn't have to ask her. She gave him a check. And that's the thing with meditation retreat. I know it's when you do learn to meditation, people can see that. They can sense it. If you want to get your partner interested in meditation and Buddhism, there's no need to give them books to read, or to give them CDs to listen to. Because I'm not going to do that. If you haven't changed, if you're, you know, you haven't walked the walk, you haven't showed the goods of a peaceful mind, of a calm mind. So the biggest way to convince somebody else is just through your action. You know, how you act and behave after you've been to the monastery. That will convince them more than anything. You see, you're a changed person, a happier, a content person, less anxious, less worried. Then they'll want to find out what you've been doing this weekend. You don't have to say anything. Any questions, comments? In our tradition, it happens on a fairly regular basis. It's not a stigma. It's actually, you see many meditation teachers actually use that as their kind of CV. I was a monk for a few years. So it's actually a positive thing to have been a monk or nun for a certain number of times, a number of years. Yeah. And like I said, in the Thai first tradition, you can disrobe up to 7 times and go in and out, no worries, but as many times as you want, and it's not a problem. People can also ordain for short term, knowing that, you know, they will come out again and to re-enter the world, but it's just to have a quiet place to practice for a month, 2 months, 3 months, or a year, and then to use that, you know, whatever clarity you mind, to go back and to help out the world, or to continue practicing. Those are good. Because some people say, you know, I have a family, I can only take 6 months off. But still, that's still valuable. Because you really can practice for 6 months and then see the difference. When you live in a busy world, it's very hard to practice. And whatever peace, that also builds up. That way it helps you, you have a certain strength, a certain inner strength, and that you can rely on when you are working in the world. Yeah, so it's beneficial, and I recommend it for anybody who, you know, as little as a month. And you don't have to also ordain as monks or nuns to get the full benefit. As long as you stay in a monastery or meditation retreat, and it's fairly quiet, you have lots of time to meditate or to live in seclusion. That's quite helpful. Yes, Raina? Well, it gets tricky when you become a big teacher, because obviously you're teaching renunciation, you're saying this is a great path, and you can imagine how you feel if I say, oh, meditation is great, holy life is great, and tomorrow I put on a pair of jeans and say, well, you know, I changed my mind. Obviously, so that will, you know, jar some people. But also, my spiritual partner, sort of, because I haven't seen him in many years, but a monk I ordained with when I was in Thailand. When I ordained with him, that was his third time. He's been back and out and in again 2 more times since. So I've seen him in Thailand. So certain monks is not a problem. And with anything, I think he is a doubting character. So he goes in and says, oh, I don't know if I made the right choice. He goes out, and then he gets out, he's like, oh no, I should have prepared the monk. So he comes back in, and he does this every few years. So yeah, I guess it's also a case-by-case basis, where how easy it is to come in and out. But also, again, this monk is fairly junior, he's not a teacher, so he just lives quietly in a monastery. And it does this thing. That's right, obviously, yeah. The 25 is the most, which is. Yes, yes. That's right. Right, there were 10 young monks who disrobed the last 2.5-3 years. But it's interesting, you see what some kind of karma that they have. There's 4 blokes, all came from Darwin, and they were childhood friends. So one guy went in, he was the leader, so he got all his friends who came in to become monks. And they hung out the whole time. And then he had doubt, so he left. So of course he talked to all his friends and leave. So now they're out, and they all, but now they share the same house. They're very strong karma, and they do they have something. They're doing this many lifetimes before. Yeah. So yeah, that aspect is also the same. And also, even not just Ajahn Brahm, but Ajahn Chah had many people who disrobed under him, and the Buddha also. So it is, it's people practice what they can, and then obstacles come up, doubts come up, uncertainty, lust, different things come up. But it's not a problem. You can, if you believe in many lifetimes, you can start off again next time, lifetime, and just continue where you left off, whatever ways you can. And I think, like the abbot, the first abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery, he was Ajahn Jagro. He was also a big controversy when he disrobed as well, or a big hoopla. Because he was abbot, he also had 20-something reigns, years as a monk, before he disrobed to marry this lady. And it's not a problem. And one of the monks, the Thai monks, who, this is kind of a hearsay, you don't know, who can, see the future or the end of past. And he says Ajahn Jagro has met this lady many times before. And the last lifetime, she also took him out the road, but he's the one who had 8 panchas. So he said, maybe next time he can be a monk for a little bit longer. So yeah, so these things, happen. So it comes and go. I'm sure the reverse has happened with nuns as well. You have some, come with some blokes or something, you see him, then, stars happen or whatever, sparks happen. That's right. It's the monks who ran away with the cook. Yes. Any other questions or comments? Contributions? Okay. Final question. Could you please tell us about enlightenment? How it feels, when, how it happens. Thank you. Okay. When it happens, I'll let you know. But actually, monks aren't allowed to talk about these kind of attainments anyway. But I was going to save this for a talk towards the end of the retreat. And not that I would know from personal experience, but also the Buddha talked many, had good many teachings regarding that. And he described what is, Nibbana, enlightenment is. And it is something, it's positive, something to work for, Can you imagine that you, feelings of anger does not arise in your mind? Not that you suppress anger, not saying, oh, because I'm a meditator, I'm not angry. No, it doesn't arise in the mind. And also feeling of lust, of craving, wanting things. That doesn't arise in the mind either. So it must be very, kind of amazing state. And certainly my experiences like that, when I've met people whose reputation of being enlightened or well attained, they're just so completely at ease. So at peace. And it's an amazing amount of compassion just to radiate outward. You feel so well loved. Is only where I can describe this person that you're sitting in front of, that he has your interest in mind when you're talking, This is worth to his issue. It's because we have our own personal issues that we can't be there for another person because we're worrying about something else. But when all that we can let go of our own personal issues, then we can really be there and we can just really care for this person in front of us with 100% devotion and 100% focus. And it's an amazing feeling. That's why you see these monks and nuns who are, you know, enlightened. But they've got lots of people sitting in front of them all day long. Because people can feel it, can sense it, and know that they can have, that they trust in them. And this person would never say or do anything that would hurt them in any way. That whatever they say, whatever advice they give, is for the welfare and happiness of this person in front of you. So it is an amazing thing to be. And it must be an amazing thing to kind of realize for yourself, actually. Yeah. I'll say more about it towards the end of the retreat. To give you something to look forward. But also, as we practice, each and every one of us here have experienced moments where, you know, our feelings and, you know, the craving, the suffering in our own life, in our own mind, has decreased somewhat. So you kind of, you know, expand on that, kind of, you know, project onto that. Yeah, as you go, this thing is, you know, it's a path of increasing happiness, it's a path of increasing comfort. You don't get more angry, you get less angry. You feel more content, more at ease, more fulfilled, more, you know, centered. You know, looking around, find your happiness outside, what people say or do towards you. You have this kind of refuge inside your own mind. If you, you know, increasingly confident, you know that you have this center inside of you, you can be happy regardless of what happens outside. And it's a very enjoyable path. I'm not enlightened, but, you know, you've tasted enough of the fruit of the practice to let you know that it's working. And you just have to continue pursuing one way you can. A little bit every day. As a child, just a simile in the practice. It's like you have this very large, you know, water jug that's above your head. You can't see into it. All you know is every day is a few drops. They're still going in. And the drops in there stands for mindfulness and clarity. And anytime you do any practice that enhances that. And the bucket stands for your path of practice. You don't know when it's going to fill. It could be tomorrow, it could be tonight before you lie down. Just like Ananda, he practiced really hard. And then he wanted to become enlightened. He sit, walk, and he couldn't get enlightened. He was so annoyed. And he has this meeting to go to. Because after the Buddha passed away, there was this big meeting that 500 arahants are invited. Except Ananda. Ananda was not enlightened, fully enlightened yet. So he was practicing really, really hard so that he can, you know, go to this meeting with his mate, being an enlightened figure. So he sat, walked the whole night. He didn't crack it. So before he went, so he said, okay, I'm giving up. That's okay. I'm just going to be a stream enterer, which is the first stage of enlightenment, but he's not fully enlightened. And you have to be fully enlightened to go to this meeting. So it's a pretty important meeting. So, but then he couldn't get enlightened, so he had to give up. So he said, okay, I'm just going to have to go there as a stream enterer. But just before his head hit the pillow, he let go. He completely let go of this wanting to be enlightened. And then he became enlightened. So that's why his water jug just filled. All he needed was a few more drops of letting go, and it happened. We don't know how, you know, how far we've gone, but all we can do, all we can be sure is that every day we incline our mind towards more clarity, inclining our mind towards letting go, towards gentleness, towards kindness. And then one day, yeah, it happens. But also, as it fills up, you can know it. You can know it for yourself. And the feeling that you are happier, more content, day by day. And that's also a good way to judge the practice. If you're getting more angry, more disappointed, more depressed, then say, what am I doing wrong? Am I going towards the right direction? Obviously, there are, you know, it's not a hunky-dory path. You're not always happy. That's not a guarantee either in Buddhism. There are patches that you know, dark things will come up from time to time. But on the whole, there should be a rise, a gradual rise in your level of consciousness. And that is the guarantee. As long as we pursue our path, one step at a time. That's great. Any more questions or comments? Yeah, generally, but there's no guarantee. Yeah, all you know is you can, you know, pick up where you left off, hopefully. But, you know, karma works in a strange way. You know, Ajahn Chah said it's just, you know, having, you know, your good karma is one end of the stick. You do lots of good karma, that'll be heavier end. And the bad karma is on the other side of the stick. You refrain from harming, hurting other people, other beings, and it's very light because it's, you know, it's not very heavy. But, you know, getting reborn is like throwing the stick up in the air. You never know which side, which end is going to come down. So that's why it's always encouragement to do as much as you can in this lifetime. Because when you look around, we'll have it pretty good. It doesn't get any better than this. This is as good as it gets. In a nice, peaceful country, we are, you know, have plenty to eat. We've got relatively good bodies, healthy bodies here to be sitting here. And the time. So in the next lifetime we can be, you know, in Africa, Middle East. You know, the environment, there's no bush left. This is a great bush. 50 years from now, you won't have a bush left. So that's why there's encouragement to always, you know, do as much as you can in this very lifetime. But also, it's not a recipe to make you feel more guilty, but it's just to know that, you know, to work, do the best given the conditions that you have. So Buddhism is always dealing with the here and now. We don't deal with ideals of what you should be doing. Shouldn't, doesn't really happen. But to deal with, yeah, what can I do now in my present circumstance? How to, you know, meditate as best as I can, a few minutes that you have. Yeah. I'm not saying to chuck away your families and friends' responsibilities, but to work within your context as best as you can. Because there's always things we can do. You can't sit for an hour, but you certainly can sit for 5 or 10 minutes a day. Sometimes during the day. Yeah, so always work with that. Good. Thank you for the questions tonight. And like I said, please just take away what you can and use. And the stuff that you don't resonate with, stuff that doesn't make any sense, just leave it in this room when you leave.